Around the world, people are working to bring a greater sense of balance to the planet. Earth Wisdom Circles is here to showcase these people and projects. Now, here's your host for Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio, Elaine Grohman.
Good afternoon. This is Elaine Grohman on Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio. As you know, the subject matter of this program is always the intention to bring individuals to the listening audience, individuals that are making a difference in the world, helping to expand our awareness of ourselves, give us some new way of seeing what we haven't seen before. And this gentleman that I have on my show right now is one such individual. I had the pleasure of interviewing him a number of years ago when I had a show on CBS, and it was very fortuitous that he came back into my awareness very recently. So my guest is Kyriakos Mercadis, who is a professor emeritus from the University of Maine. He is certainly a global traveler, a man of the world. And his work that I'm speaking about today, but we can go into many things, is his most latest book called The Accidental Immigrant, A Quest for Spirit in a Skeptical Age. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ellen. That's very nice of you to invite me.
Oh, I'm pleased. I'm very pleased. So please, if you will, give us a little background about yourself and where you came from and how it is that you came into this work of studying the unique world of spirit and our own human development.
Well, it's been a series of extraordinary synchronicities and coincidences that brought me to this kind of work, because my training was in political sociology. And then, as a result of certain developments in my life, I came into contact with individuals like yourself, healers, who really changed my worldview radically. Now, originally, I came from Cyprus, and some people may not know where that is. That's in the Eastern Mediterranean, a little island, the third in size, actually, in the Mediterranean, not far from Israel and Lebanon.
Yes.
And I came to the United States on a boat in 1960, because that was the means of transportation of that time.
Yeah.
And the reason why I came here is because I had relatives in Ohio, who sent me a visa so that I could come and study here. I had no way of studying outside of Cyprus because I wasn't rich. So the invitation to come to the United States was quite a kind of a jackpot for me, because it opened possibilities for me that I never would have been able to even dream before that. So I came to New York. At the docks of New York, I met one of my relatives there, an uncle that I have never met because he left in the 20s.
Oh.
And eventually ended up, after a couple of weeks, I ended up in Youngstown, Ohio, where my other relatives lived. And my aunt, Eleni, who also sent me the visa to come to the United States. So I am the beneficiary of her generosity and also those other kind of coincidences that radically changed my life. I came here to get a business degree. I didn't come here to become a professor. I thought I would get a bachelor's degree in business administration, majoring in accounting and minoring in economics, because I wanted to go back to Cyprus and make a living. But that was a time during the most difficult times in American history, the 60s.
Yes.
So I lived through the missile crisis. I experienced the tragedies of John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, the hippie revolution. So by my senior year, studying business, I said, what am I doing in business? The world is on fire, and I am wasting my time with balance sheets and numbers. So I felt deeply depressed that somehow I found myself in the wrong field. I was doing well. I was a member of the honorary accounting fraternity. I was considered to be a good student in statistics and accounting, but something was missing in my life. And that what was missing was really trying to make sense of the world. Mm. Coming from Cyprus, after spending the decade experiencing the anti-colonial movement there, that was a time of a lot of violence and assassinations and hangings and curfews. The island was under British rule at the time. So coming to America, I found different kinds of troubles, namely the international troubles that we are all familiar with. So all of those things generated all kinds of questions in my mind. What is the nature of reality? Why are Americans different than myself? How is it Americans celebrate a different kind of flag? And I was celebrating a different kind of flag when I was in Cyprus, the Greek flag. So I said to myself, something must be a problem here. So I didn't know how to find the answers. And accidentally, I met a sociology student, and I befriended him. We became friends. And then I realized that maybe I should try sociology. So to make a long story short, I went to the chair of the sociology department, a very nice lady that I had as an undergraduate or as a first-year student. And she was sympathetic to my problem. And he said, well, why don't you apply to different schools and see if they can give you a graduate assistantship for your master's degree and beyond? Well, I started applying. I was accepted in several of them, but no financial assistance. And I couldn't do it on my own. So I went to Mrs. Botti and I said, I appreciate your efforts, but I think I'm giving up. I'm going back to Cyprus with my business degree. And that would be that. And then I said to my hairs, here are the applications from Bowling Green State. I don't think I'll bother to finish them, to fill them, because I know what the answer would be. And then she got angry at me and she said, go home and fill up those forms. You are missing your chances. Mm. And that changed my life.
You needed that stern direction.
I filled those forms. And in a month's time, I got a call from Bowling Green State, giving me full assistance without any background in sociology.
Oh my goodness.
So that was a godsend, and that's how I started my sociological career. After I got my master's degree, I wanted to go on to for a doctoral degree. In the meantime, I was yearning to go back to Cyprus because that was my intention. I didn't come here to stay. I wasn't here as an immigrant. My visa was non-immigrant alien. I was a non-immigrant alien. I went to a secretary one time and I introduced myself as a non-immigrant alien, and she looked at me with a strange look. What is this kind of non-immigrant alien?
Yes.
So I eventually got my doctoral degree in sociology. I was still planning to go back to Cyprus, but I went to Chicago to say goodbye to a friend of mine, a former professor of mine. And then he introduced me to one of his colleagues at the university, at Northwestern University. And as a result of that conversation, he said, why are you going back to Cyprus? Why don't you stay in America and maybe you can find a job at a good research university? I said to him, I'm not looking for a job. But if a job finds me, I may consider it for a couple of years to get the training as a professor. Well, I left him with an article that I wrote, and then in about another month, I got a call from the University of Maine. They were reconstituting the sociology department, and they wanted somebody to come and become part of the faculty. And that's how I ended up in Maine. So the 2 years ended up becoming 48 at the University of Maine. In the meantime, my training was in political sociology, and my early work was in politics, in social movements. But then, during my first sabbatical, I met a medicine man in Cyprus, a Christian healer. And I was so excited to meet him because he was so extraordinary. And I heard so many things about him that it dawned on me that maybe it would have made more sense, instead of writing a book on international terrorism, that I had the material to write about it at the time, become a kind of a field researcher, a participant observer into the world of this unusual individual. Now, before I got there, I was prepared, consciously or unconsciously, to accept somebody like him. Because had I went there when I was studying for my degree, I probably would not have paid much attention. But then a friend of mine introduced me to the works of Carlos Castaneda, to the meditation of Maharishi Yogi. He was a meditator himself. He was also a sociologist, so he had credentials in my own eyes, as somebody who knew what was happening. So I met him, and I spent the next 10 years studying him. I published The Magus of Strobolos, the Homage to the Sun and Fire in the Heart, and several other books beyond that. After I went to Mount Athos in Greece and met a monk who had all the charismatic abilities of great saints, and I spent another 10 years studying him, and I publish another trilogy, starting with the Mountain of Silence and Gifts of the Desert and Inner River. These are the books that I've been studying. And instead of me focusing on international terrorism, I focused on mystics and healers. So because I said to myself at first, well, these mystics and healers seems to be much more interesting than terrorists. And that's how I ended up writing these books. So, well,
I am very grateful that you did.
Thank you.
Because I think that, thank you for sharing that story, because I think that it is so beautiful. And, you know, we don't realize where everyone comes from. Yeah. You came from a very challenging place, as many people around the world do. And I think that it was so what is so fascinating about the fact that you are studying the spirit is that, you know, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but the typical study of sociology is the study of trouble.
Yes.
But to understand spirit is the study of peace and
yes.
workability. And yes. I think that we give too much emphasis to the problem rather than the solution.
Well, this has been the position of many humanistic psychologists, including of one of my intellectual mentors, Peter Im Sorokin, that I mentioned in my Accidental Immigrant, that we have overemphasized the study of what is bad about human beings, and we have not focused on what is great. So in a sense, we have a skewed understanding of human nature, and we developed a kind of a very negative view of the innermost recesses of human nature. So this is a corrective. When we study great sages and mystics and healers and philosophers, we are studying people who are the best among us. And therefore, we get a glimpse of what we may be ourselves.
Yes, and what many have been.
Yes.
And I think that what, you know, it's interesting because much of your book focuses on Christianity and Orthodoxy. And in my studies, and I'm nowhere near the amount of books that I'm working on my third book, so I'm trying to catch up to you a little bit. you know, I think that we have a tendency to incorrectly bundle religion and make it synonymous with God or creation.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's religion is an organization. And in
well, you
fact,
have to. Yeah.
Yes, but it's the understanding of this gift that we have in the quest, as the subtitle of your book, The Quest for Spirit in a Skeptical Age. We already are spirit. And we're having
yes.
an experience that's called life.
Well, this is the great insight that is the result of this accumulated development of human consciousness up to this point. And when I was studying as a during the 60s, my 60s education turned me into an agnostic, because most of the people that I encountered, either as professors or as people that I had to read about, were secularists. And they were people who were assuming that the only reality there is the reality of the five senses. It took me quite some time to realize that there is a reality over and beyond the physical world. And now, modern science is leading in that direction. Anthony Flew, who has been a leading atheist philosopher, came to the conclusion that there is a God. And he wrote a book, There Is a God, which really shocked his fellow atheists, because he was a star of the atheist movement. And he said what led him to believe is science, that science gives us a worldview now that is not compatible with materialism. And many of the philosophers that we read in school, in university classrooms, are philosophers who were nurtured with 19th century worldviews. And in terms of cosmology, they thought that the universe is just a brute fact and there is no need for an interpretation or explanation. And therefore, people like Marx, like Freud, like Nietzsche, like Bernard Russell, like Sartre, these are the leading thinkers that we read about in literature classes and university classes. I don't think they would have continued along these lines if they came in contact with the Big Bang theory of the universe that is now the consensus among cosmologists, and also the current revelations that we get about the nature of the world through quantum physics, through the near-death experience and the mushrooming studies about people who died and came back to tell us about how they felt in the out-of-body state. All of these things has led me personally, and I believe thousands, if not millions of others, to the same conclusion, that we are living a great mystery and the universe itself is a hierophany or a spiritual manifestation. And that's how we should see it, and that we ourselves are spirit, trying to understand, trying to understand not only ourselves, but by understanding ourselves, we understand the world.
Yes, and the great teachings of the medicine wheels, which is a body of knowledge of the ancients from the Americas, was that, you know, life itself is where all sciences were derived from, because sciences are the study of life.
Exactly. But
we have gotten, unfortunately, to a position where it's more of the dissection of it, the dismantling of it, rather than the watching the workability of it. And I think that that's what we need to really look at going forward in our humanity.
I see science as a divine gift, that it is part of this unfoldment of human consciousness. And, you know, scientists may call themselves atheists, some scientists or many scientists, but deep down they are doing the work of spirit.
Yes.
But they are not aware of it.
Yeah.
And I do believe that if we are to have world peace, and if our species is going to survive in the long term, we have to bring a kind of an understanding between the sciences and spirituality, in between the religions among themselves and science, that we are all in the same soup trying to make sense of the world that we find ourselves in. And everybody can contribute a little bit into this holistic understanding of the world.
So let me ask you, please, and again, my guest is Kyriakos Markidis, and he is the author of many books. His latest, The Accidental Immigrant, A Quest for Spirit in a Skeptical Age. Can you tell me, please, how was it that you felt an interior and intellectual transformation when you witnessed and spoke with healers. What did that do to the paradigm that you believed you were studying or you believed that was real at that time?
Yeah, there was a preparation for me to meet these healers on their own level because I was exposed to the word, to the work of Peterin Sorokin, the founder of the sociology department, who was a Russian refugee from Soviet Russia and came to the United States after he was being sentenced to death there because he was not a Bolshevik, he was a Menshevik. And he was going to be executed the next day. And one of his former students, a Bolshevik, went to Lenin and pleaded for him to save Sorokin's life. And Lenin... Wow. Let him out. So here is this man who expected to be executed the next morning, and now he's out, and they gave him his position back at the University of St. Petersburg, or what became Leningrad. So there was a period of where he could leave the Soviet Union and came to the United States. He got a position at the University of Minnesota for 5 years, made a name for himself as a great sociologist, and then Harvard invited him to build the sociology department during the 30s. And I accidentally, quote unquote, I had to write a term paper about him. And he blew my mind because he was thinking differently than most of the people that I encounter. Mm-hmm. He claimed that reality is not the reality only of the senses, not only of the mind, but also of intuition.
Yes.
And in the West, we have only honored the senses and the mind, but we neglected intuition as a source of knowledge.
Yes.
And he said the great sages of humanity were virtuosi of the third eye of looking at reality, namely through intuition. So we need, he said, to develop integralist truth that will honor all three strands of knowledge. The knowledge of the senses, namely science, the knowledge of the mind, namely logic and philosophy, and the eye of intuition that gives us insight into higher worlds. And that stuck in my mind and prevented me from becoming a thorough agnostic during the 60s. So when I met this colleague of mine, Stephen Marks, who was hired at the same time as I was, and we started conversing about these issues. So he started passing to me all kinds of books, including the trilogy or tetralogy of the of Castagneta. So I was excited. I said, maybe there is a reality over and beyond what our sciences allowed us to believe. And it was this kind of suspicion. I remember I was reading a book by Doug Boyd, Rolling Thunder, which was a Native American.
And
when
Marvel
I,
book.
Yeah, when I met Daskalos, I said, "My God, he's the Christian equivalent of Rolling Thunder at the time." Mm. And this is what triggered me to make the quantum leap to give up political sociology, not in terms of my teaching, but in terms of my research and writing, and become a participant observer in the world of Daskalos. And by doing so, I witness extraordinary phenomena with my own senses, not with any intuition. Mm-hmm. He was able to describe the inside of my house from Maine without ever me telling him about it. In fact, he told me I should put a telephone upstairs so that I don't roll down every time the telephone rings in case I break my neck. How did he know that I didn't?
Right.
And he identified the problem of a woman in New York by just looking at her picture, that her problems were in her teeth. And eventually her teeth exploded and mucus was dripping from the holes. I witnessed him heal a woman who had problems with her spine, and the doctors gave up on her. They told her that she had to stay in bed. She even went to the top university in Israel for an examination, and the doctors told her the same thing as the local doctors in Cyprus. How did she know? How did she do it? I was present when he was barely passing his hands over her back, and in about 35, 40 minutes, she was on her feet, her problem never coming back again. And then she went to her radiologist, and they took x-rays, and the x-ray showed a very perfectly healthy spine. And I saw this woman 10 years later, and she was this fine, and she was bringing somebody for Daskalos to help in terms of her own spine. So I witnessed all these things. And then when you do that, then you have to ask the question, what kind of world do these people live in? And then I sat with Daskalos, and he gave me a very elaborate system of knowledge that thoroughly impressed me. Here is a man who has never been outside of Cyprus for any length of time. He spent a couple of years in Kenya, I believe, after the invasion of Cyprus by Turkey in 1974. But he had only a high school degree. But when I conversed with him, I felt that I had in front of me a great philosopher. And I wrote in great detail about what he was saying, what is the worldview that he lives in. And he was talking about having not only this physical body, but three bodies, the psychic, noetic, and the physical. He was talking about when we die, the only thing that dies is the physical body, but we continue with the psychonoetic body, and that every particle of matter has its etheric counterpart and psychic counterpart and noetic counterpart. Great detail. And that the self is ultimately spirit, but it acquires this kind of physical body gradually as we come down from spirit to soul, to permanent personality, to noetic, to the noetic body, the psychic, and then the gross material at birth. So that really took my attention. And then he was talking about the universe as being permeated by etheric energy. Later on, I found out that this is exactly what all the healers are talking about.
Yes.
And the Chinese talk about qi energy. I've seen qi energy being demonstrated at the National Institute of Health when the Office of Alternative Therapies was created. And Effie Chow showed us the power of qi, demonstrating to us how it works. So all of these things changed my worldview.
What is so interesting is that, you know, you said, what world does Daskalos live in? Well, he lives in the same world as you and I.
Yes.
It is just that we have often, I think sometimes when people, the more educated they can be, sometimes the narrower their thinking might become.
Well, that's because of the way we have defined the self. We have assumed that the brain and the mind is one and the same thing. It is not. I mean, it is possible for mind to exist outside of the body. So for me, this perspective was reinforced by reading American authors and non-American authors who had the kind of academic credentials that impresses people, such as doctors, such as scientists, even engineers from Princeton who have studied the impact of mind over matter. I've been around these people because spending time in places like the New York Open Center, the Shivananda Yoga Retreat on Paradise Island, the International Institute of Integral Human Sciences in Montreal. These are places where these ideas are being discussed by people from different traditions, different religions, different sciences. And therefore, the consensus And my own understanding is that we live within this great mystery, and that we have an unlimited potential in terms of understanding it. We are not doomed to ignorance, in other words. The meaning of life, as I pointed out in my latest book, is really to develop two things: to learn how to love, genuinely love, and also to learn, to know, those two things.
Yes, I had the opportunity one time to be with a Quechuan elder in Peru. And he was so beautiful and humble and gracious. And there was this, even though he was in advanced age, he literally, and not a wrinkle on his skin, he literally looked timeless. Uh-huh. And he shared with us that, as you just spoke, every human is here for exactly the same purpose. And that is to know and to be the spirit that we are.
That's
to
right.
To understand and work with the love that we are. That is a power and not an emotion.
And
to take action.
Yes. I mean, this is the fundamental teaching of all the great spiritual traditions.
Yes. Now,
in my case, Daskalos passed away in the mid-90s. And it so happened at that time, a friend of mine invited me for a trip to Mount Athos in Greece, where it's a peninsula in northern Greece, 20 miles long, 10 miles wide. And he said to me, if you really want to meet saints, come with me to Mount Athos. And I was very reluctant at the time because I thought, what could Mount Athos teach us? I thought it was just a refuge of a lot of ignorant people who decided to leave the world and become monks and hermits. Well, I was wrong. There is a lot of superstition, of course, in every organized kind of religion. But I discovered there that there are some great individuals who demonstrate all these abilities that I thought could be found only in outside of organized Christianity. That within organized Christianity, there are the great sages and the great mystics. And I spent almost 20 years now studying those people. And I've written a series of books, starting with The Mountain of Silence. And what I found there was a great spiritual tradition that is not very well known in the West. And this is what I try to convey to in my writings. I followed the same method of becoming an apprentice, a participant observer, and I was delighted to meet some people who really ooze this kind of love that we aspire to become, even though we are deep down that.
Yes, and I think that those kind of individuals, and I've had the pleasure of meeting some as well, that there is this quality of their energy. And as we know, the laws of attraction and those things, they affect us because we too are electromagnetic. We're atomic beings, and atoms react. It's an atomic reaction. So a healing is not a mystery. A healing is a correction.
Uh-huh.
And when we understand that, the body has this intelligence within itself that is far superior to our knowledge. Thank goodness we don't have to tell our body to beat our heart or to digest our food or to make a peptide. We wouldn't even know where to begin. We'd be dead in a second because there's so much happening simultaneously.
Well, yes, and I've met people on Mount Athos who had the reputation of doing extraordinary things in terms of healing. And of course, they reject the notion that they are doing any healing.
Right.
It's not us who are doing the healing. It's God. It's the Holy Spirit. One time I met Elder Baisios. He was a very well-known elder on Mount Athos. And I heard so many stories about him being present in two places at the same time, being seen in rooms where people were about to die, or healing people from a distance. So he was a legend. And I was told, you know, when you go to see him, please do not ask him how he does those healings, because he does not like it. He refused to accept any credit. For him, these are all just rumors that people say about him. So I went there. It was 4 hours walk on the mountains, and like a yogi in the Himalayas or somewhere, we went to see him. And I was very impressed with him, not because of his great stories about him, but what a good human being he was, cracking one joke after another, making us laugh. And we took turns to spend a few minutes by ourselves with him. So when my time came to have a chat with him, I don't know, maybe some devil prompted me to ask the question, Father, how do you do those healings? And he stiffened up and he said, my son, I don't do any healing. It's God that does any healing. I just pray here. Mm-hmm. And he was telling Father Maximus, who was one of his intimate disciples, that people come and tell me that I do, they see me here, they see me there, they think I am doing this or that. It's the Holy Spirit who does all these things. All I do, I am praying here for different categories of people. And sometimes I see myself like in a dream, being here and there, doing healings, but it's not me, because I am here. And then people come and tell me, we saw you here. I haven't gone anywhere, he said. I am just praying here. So he says his theory is that the Holy Spirit picks the image of the person who is genuinely praying for somebody and uses that image to carry out whatever healings takes place.
Well, if we understand that we're all connected to everything that exists.
Yes.
And we don't understand necessarily the mechanism of how, even how you and I in this moment can be in separate parts of the country and have a clear, easy conversation with being able to see. All of this is a mystery to most people, but it happens nonetheless. And we wonder, I wonder, you know, is it this geometry, what is called sacred geometry, this connectedness of everything that projects a hologram that is no less valid than what's right in front of you. And, you know, we don't know how time and space is used and interacted with. Many people do, as you had said. You know, they know how to be in that space and create the space for what appears to be impossible to not only be possible, but seemingly effortless.
Yes, and I've met people who came to reveal to me their experiences. And there was a French professor who came to see me, and he told me that he was working with a yogi in India somewhere, and they had to cross a gorge that would have taken 45 minutes to call. And then he somehow appeared on the other side, and it took me 45 minutes to get there. How did he get there? I mean, these are mysteries that it blew his mind himself. But to go back to the Mount Athos thing, what impressed me also was their worldview, that I called it the threefold way. I borrowed it from Buddhism, the Eightfold Path, and when I used the word the threefold path, my editor said, "Are you sure you want to use a Buddhist-sounding term? Why not a more Christian?" I said, okay, how about the threefold way? And what all the people that I met on Mount Athos, including Elder Baisios, who incidentally, they made him into a saint, and they consecrated a church in his honor. And I went there, and I saw his image that they painted. And he looks like a very somber saint. And I said to myself, but I knew him. He was very funny. He's not so somber. But when, in iconography, they make them look like very serious. Anyway, what they teach is that all human beings go through three stages before they can reach God. The stage of catharsis, the stage of enlightenment or theosis, and God realization or theosis, the threefold way. So the only place where we can work with our consciousness is the stage of catharsis. Catharsis meaning to overcome our egotism, to overcome our self-centeredness. And they offer all kinds of methods on how to practice the method of cleaning yourself from egotistical desires so that enlightenment comes in as a gift from God and then eventually union with God. So that is what I would call the threefold way that was the consensus among the people that I interviewed, both on Mount Athos and outside of Mount Athos.
Can I ask you, in Mount Athos and the monks that you met there, did they ever attempt to go out into the world to share this knowledge, or how was that encountered, or was it only sequestered in that location?
No, they, Father Maximus planned to spend all his time on Mount Athos when his elders ordered him to leave Mount Athos and go to Cyprus to revitalize monasticism there. And that's where I spent time with him in the monastery, being his chauffeur on the mountain because he doesn't drive. So as we get into the car, he would keep telling me about the spiritual tradition that he experienced himself. The fact that they were able to talk to me and share their worldview that I wrote into American publications, that shows that they are interested in showing to the world what they have. Now, it is a mistake to think that every monk you meet is a self-realized human being. Because you find also a lot of ignorance and superstition. As Father Maximus would say, the church is like a hospital, or it ought to be like a hospital. And in a hospital, you find people who are ill and they need healing and they need therapy, just like you find doctors, namely the great elders, who can help those who are sick come to health. So what is the healing that they're talking about? It's not just physical healing. It's the totality of healing of the self, meaning the overcoming egotism and union with the great spirit or God or whatever you want to call it.
Yes. And some of the mentors that I've been privileged to work with, they say that we are not having a life. We are life being lived.
Okay. That's a very nice way of putting it.
Because we have this easy way that we distance ourselves, and we don't realize that our thought processes are so either beneficial or detrimental to our health, because any thought creates a chemical reaction in the body. And so if we have unkind, hateful, divisive thoughts, it is affecting us first. And it's lowering that vibration so that we can't even see over the horizon to any other possibilities, because our physiology isn't capable because we keep such a low vibration.
Well, this is the insight of the great sages who developed the golden rule. Do unto others what you like them to do unto you, meaning that whatever we do to others eventually comes back to us. Mm-hmm. So it is in our best interest to be kind and loving than hateful and angry.
Yes. So, and I would say to do to yourself what you are doing to others first, rather than the other way around. Because if you're angry, you feel it first. If you're judgmental, you feel it first.
Yeah. Have you ever met an angry person who is happy?
No. And seeing the individuals that I do, you see the ramifications of their thought processes and what it does to their physiology, what it does to their emotional state, what it does to their psyche.
Yeah, unfortunately many biologists or many scientists see that connection as coming the other way around, that somehow it is the biology, it is the brain that generates the mind instead of the other way around. The current understanding is that the brain is like a battery, that it can be a vehicle of electricity, But when the battery dies, it doesn't mean that electricity does not exist. Right. So, yes, there are equivalents to the body in terms of our thoughts, but it's our thoughts that generate those body conditions.
Well, speaking of that, and your so much of what you speak about has to do with religion and Christianity and various forms of religion. How have you seen religion perhaps be very detrimental, not inclusive? Because we see so many instances in our world where a quote-unquote holy war,
yes,
is raged in, but there's such ideologies that are so against life itself.
Right.
Against half of humanity, meaning women. And because women and children are always the ones who suffer the greatest.
Exactly. Well, you find this problem in all the great religions. And you'll find among those great religions the very exalted kind of individuals who really understand the inner self, so to speak. And you find people at very low levels of understanding that religion, namely generating fanaticism, xenophobia, and all kinds of negative kind of feelings. That's a betrayal of those religions. So I would say, for example, that somebody like Mahatma Gandhi or some of the great yogis have more in common with Christian mystics than among some of their religionists who kill in the name of their religion.
Right.
So you can be a Christian, but violating all the Christian values. We have this example in our country today where hateful kind of expressions of religiosity push us away from the basic teachings of Christianity.
Yes, and I think that sometimes people use that as an excuse for they do something because their religion says they can.
Well, you know, developmental psychologists also have this notion that people are at different stages of moral development. There are those who have a global understanding of morality, and there are those who would reject anybody who is not part of their tribe. So you can be a Christian nominally and kill for the sake of your religion, or a Muslim kill for the sake of religion. Or you can be a Christian who is like Elder Baizios or Elder Porfirios that I know about, or Mother Teresa, and they are part of the same religion. So when we look at the religions in terms of what they have done in terms of harm to the world, we have to keep in mind that this is the grossest and most incorrect way of expressing their religiosity. So what we need to do is to make the more exalted and the more real expression of that religion more widely shared. For example, in Islam, you have the Sufis. In Judaism, you have the Kabbalists. In Christianity, you have the great mystics. In Buddhism and Hinduism, you have the great yogis and the great lamas. And you have people like the Dalai Lama that expresses the most exalted version of that religion. So when we talk about, like the neo-atheists, that the root of all evil is religion, they are ignorant about the nature of religion, I think, in the sense that they get the worst expressions of those religions and they draw general conclusions, ignoring what is the fact that people like Martin Luther King were also Christians. Not only those who blow clinic that carry out abortion. So we have to be careful not to lump everybody in the same soup, because there are people at very low levels of consciousness and people at different levels of consciousness. So we live in this kind of hierarchical world of consciousness. Mm-hmm. And it is in our best interest to go to the highest levels, yes, meaning to get deeper into ourselves.
And I think that we're in a time of, in the indigenous world, they talk about this time as what they call the time of the prophecy of change, where we are really examining who and what we believe how we live our lives? Is it going to be something that is going to enhance life or destroy life? And I think that fundamentally we have to look at every religion, I believe, since most religions are patriarchal. We have to look at that fundamental flaw.
Exactly.
Of how is it that that which births is somehow demonized?
That's right. Yeah, this is a flaw that needs to be corrected.
Yes.
I think time will do that.
And I think that you and I and the conversations that people have, the books that are written.
Yeah, we live in a radically different world than the world when these religions came into the forefront. Mm-hmm. The religions of the world developed independent of each other because of mountains, deserts, oceans. Now these barriers collapsed. We have airplane travel. We have these kind of communications. So these religions have to come to terms with one another and not to demonize each other. That's number one. And also they have to terms with what modern science has to offer. And the sciences have to really open their eyes to the insights of the great sages. It is not accidental, perhaps, that Oppenheimer recited the Bhagavad Gita when the explosion took place of the first nuclear experiment in Los Alamos. And he recited, which means that some modern scientists, at least, have become aware of this wider reality.
And I think that we have to be, in regard to Oppenheimer, aware of what you're participating in.
Exactly.
You cannot just, you know, they say it's easier to ask for absolution than permission.
Yeah.
You know, because if it's already done, then you've participated.
Yeah.
And to simply ask for forgiveness is a big problem.
And the problem, of course, is ideology, including secular ideology. Peter Berger, the sociologist, said, when we make a calculus of pain and we put all the blame on the religions, we have to keep in mind that most of the great genocides that were committed in history were done by ideology, political ideologies,
yes.
Whether it's communism, Nazism, you name them. So we really need to bring peace among the religions and peace among religions and science. We'll have a better understanding about who we are, collectively speaking.
Yes.
And then we can perhaps solve the problems of the planet that need to be solved before we blow ourselves up.
Yes. Well, in the last few minutes that we have left, again, my guest is Kyriakos Markadis and his new book, The Accidental Immigrant, A Quest for Spirit in a Skeptical Age, is available, and your publisher was gracious enough to offer a 30% discount. That will be on the Empower Radio website, so those who listen can go to the website and see how they can get a copy of your book. But how would you like people to be able to reach out to you if they want to have questions, if they'd like to invite you to speak? What is your preferred means of contact?
Email, I think, which is very simple, markidis@maind.edu.
Okay, very good. So thank you. So where do you go from here? This cannot be your last book.
I hope the spirit will guide me.
So how have you found that all of your writings have opened doors for you to be more and more? And I would imagine this book, you know, this is a world of immigrants. You know, my heritage is from Ireland and France and Belgium. And, you know, we all come from somewhere.
Yes.
And we have to be so mindful of how we label one another.
Exactly.
And
yes.
Because it does more harm than good.
Well, this is why I think the United States has the potential of being in the forefront of this global awareness, that it is a society based not on tribal identities, but on commitment to certain core values. This is what connects us, the values embedded in the American Constitution, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, et cetera, et cetera. and democracy. We have to really learn how to live with one another without the fear of one group dominating the others or one party dominating others. And we have to learn also to abide by the rules of the game and not to violate them.
And we have to understand that when, you know, the North American continent was inhabited for 10,000 years.
Exactly.
And that our, at minimum, and that we already were a seafaring tribe of people globally, and that there our history has been so manipulated. And we forget that even the indigenous people that lived here on this North American continent, of course, there was those who had trouble, but they learned to find a workable solution. And our U.S. democracy is taken from the Iroquois Confederacy.
Yes.
That Chief Shenandoah, who tried to give a wampum belt, or did give a wampum belt, actually was stolen by the United States government, to help us them understand the what's called the White Roots of Peace. And it's these tenets of awareness, of appreciation of life, that we did not create our own lives. We didn't give ourselves our body. We don't know how to make a single cell.
Well, the Native Americans have a lot to teach us.
Yes, they certainly do. And that is very important for us all to be aware of, that that we cannot try to own people. We need to learn how to work with people, because many have things like, just like the Magus of Strobilus, who knew things that we need to know now.
Very well said.
I want to thank you so much for writing your books, for the dedication that you have given to all that you have done. And it must be wonderful to have your own wife, who is a peacekeeper, who works with the understanding of peace, which is a part of healing. Your wife, Emily, who you speak about so lovingly in your book. And so I want to thank you for being on the show. My guest has been Kreyakos Markadis. I want to thank you for who you are and for what you do.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much. And this is Elaine Grohlman on Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio. Please know that you are walking on a sacred planet, your Earth, who gives you everything that we need. And it is our opportunity to learn how to work with life instead of against life. Thank you.